All right, you're listening to I Hate Music on WCWM Williamsburg, and I'm joined today by my friend Monty, better known by the musical moniker Sime. You may remember her from a previous appearance on I Hate Music in 2022 when we talked about her album, The Independence of Central America Remains an Unfinished Experiment. Today we're going to be talking about her upcoming release, Laurels of the End of History, which is out everywhere on August 18th. Monty, thanks for joining me again on I Hate Music.
Of course, it's always nice to be able to come on and speak to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing peachy keen.
So before we get too deep in the weeds about this upcoming album, I wanted to go back to Unfinished Experiment because in a recent Instagram post where you kind of outlined Laurels, you described it as being the antithesis of Unfinished Experiment. So for those who are unfamiliar with your music, could you briefly define The Independence of Central America Remains an Unfinished Experiment and how Laurels kind of functions in relation to it?
For sure. So The Independence of Central America Remains an Unfinished Experiment, which for, I guess, the purposes of this question, if I have to refer to the name, I'll just be calling it by its abbreviation, TKRU, it's a lot easier, quicker to say, or any variation thereof. The independence or unfinished experiment is an album that is centered around. It's an allegory about my life. For one, it's a call to action, kind of for the present day geopolitical situation for Central America, and it is a. Reflection on the past from independence onward. And so I use history as a pretext to kind of talk about these things, drawing comparisons between historical events and my life, or drawing comparisons from historical events and how those connect to the current day instability of the region. And so the album is marked with a lot of spoken word interludes. It's a very I would say operatic experience in a lot of ways, in that I was inspired by this album by this band called Quilapayún, which is a Chilean Nueva Canción Latinoamericana, that's a new Latin American song. And so the album is called Santa Maria de Iquique, and that is kind of structured in the same way, where there's songs that kind of are outlining a story, and in the middle there's spoken word, like interludes, to kind of show what's going on. It's poetry. And so some of the most common criticisms I heard about it were that people didn't really like the spoken word, they didn't really like the instrumentation, they didn't necessarily like some of the songwriting, the lyricism. They thought it was a bit clunky. And, you know, while I would never say that it's a correction, because I think everything I do is everything it needs to be at the time it's released, and that's kind of the philosophy I go into with everything, I did want to kind of throw a bone to that crowd, because I kind of get where they're coming from, even if I think they're wrong. And so the way that I went into approaching this was kind of by doing that, like no spoken word interludes, but a very, very intensive compositional process. Like I went into it, you know, scoring every song, every instrument of every song. And making it, I guess, more accessible in some ways, but also, you know, in some ways, I think it's equally as avant-garde, I guess, if you want to use that word, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, for example, with the lyricism, people take issue with it because they don't really understand what's going on. But for this, I think it's a lot easier to understand that every song is an individual story. But in the same way, there's a lot still to be gleaned and a lot to look into and read into and, you know, for further related readings, I suppose, you know. So yeah, that's, I guess, how they can compare, if that makes sense to you.
Sure, absolutely. So now going into Laurels, in the first song, which is called Oberatura Neoliberal, you make reference to Cajacamasa, which is a lost city in Honduras, also known as the lost city of the monkey god. And that imagery is featured pretty prominently on the album cover. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how Cajacamasa is significant to the album's narrative, or, you know, if it's just significant to that song.
Well, you know, there's been this fixation on the lost city, the monkey god, also known as the white city, which is what Cajacamasa means. I'll probably use them interchangeably. Mm-hmm. I particularly like the imagery of it because the way it relates back to, I mean, even the names themselves, right? The lost city, the monkey god, is a kind of a westernized kind of name interpretation of what, like, of the legend they're describing. And it was it got a foothold in the American consciousness in the 1940s. I think the magazine, it was like, you know, one of those pulp kind of periodicals. Mm-hmm. I think called the American Weekly or something like that. And it was like this very, very sensationalist, pseudoscience, like, adjacent stuff. And I think it's really interesting because Latin America in particular has always kind of been a source of fascination with for pseudoscientists. Like, you know, you might think of stuff like the lost continent of Ma, right? Which was like the kind of like an extension of Atlantis, which is really funny to me. It's always been really funny because Atlantis is a political allegory. It wasn't like meant to be a thing, but people take it like reality. And so it's an extension of that. And it comes from the fact that when we were discovering, you know, like the Maya civilization, the response was these Mexicans, these Latinos could not have made this. What? So there must be some lost link. And so the kind of connection being made there is, first of all, it's kind of a reflection on exotification and a reclamation of that. And second of all, so Cajacamasa and the White City have taken up space in the Honduran collective consciousness as kind of a representation of a lost hope or like political autonomy that there once was but no longer isn't, it kind of reminds me of, you know, the kind of cultural baggage that I think like the concept of Han in Korea, you know, or like the kind of space that Hiroshima and Nagasaki represent for Japanese people. And I think that iconography is very much like similar to that, but I'm looking for a specific word. But it doesn't matter. An equal, right? Like it's whatever. The point is that it's a reflection on that, especially with, you know, the kind of lyrics in the song, right? The opening line to the album, El espejo del pueblo de que pierde refleja laureles que alumbran la avenida de nuestra historia que todos nos espera. That's the laurels. Wait, hold up. No, the mirror of the pueblo, that's like, you know, it can be both a village but also like a people, you know. It's kind of, you know, a very culturally like prominent word. The idea of the pueblo can be your people, your town, right? And so it's a pun, this line, el pueblo que pierde, that's both the people that are lost, but the people that have lost, you know, like lost as opposed to winning, but also like lost in the woods, you know.
Sure.
The mirror of the people that have lost reflects laurels, which illuminate the avenue of our history, which awaits us all. And I think that with that in mind, it kind of starts to make more sense. It's kind of like, you know, as a representation of a lost history, right? Both literally and metaphorically, right? Kind of as a, especially when you look at the album cover, as like a path, you know, like you're looking at it, it's a path to the temple, right? What does that mean, you know?
Yeah, and that kind of leads perfectly into my next question, because in that same Instagram post, you know, with the you know, talk about how Laurels connects to Guru, you also tell us that you believe that to be an artist is to transgress, and that the act of creating art is kind of like merging the past and present and future. So if you could go a little more into what the importance of time is within your work, and specifically in Laurels.
I think time is something that, like you say, kind of holistically, it's something I focus on a lot in my work. As I was describing in the first question, right? Like with Tikaru being so focused on the past, present, and future. I think that for this one, it's very much in the same way, kind of focused on bringing everything together. I mean, there's things like, you know, stories are a way of us understanding the world, right? And we can kind of glean so much, you know, whether things are different or things are kind of the same. Like, you know, there's the, you know, I don't know if you ever like learned about, you know, or like heard weird, you know, stories about Mozart, and then you're like, man, these people are really not that different from us. Those people were weird. Uh-huh. Those people were strange. You know, and like, for example, on Maya, on Laurels, there's Yoro, which is kind of an interesting little anecdote about the Lluvia de Peces, that's fish rain, which happens every year in Honduras, and kind of gleaning something from that, you know, every story is a fable if you really go about it in the right way, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're all like, you know, same thing with the opening line. They're all a laurel of the history, right? Not certainly the end of history. That's something else, but there's something to be learned from everything. And I think that that's kind of the importance of time, you know, in creating the future we want to see. We have to take from history what we are meant to learn.
Got it. Yeah, you also mentioned being influenced by the work of the philosophers Jacques Derrida and Mark Fisher, which I assume is kind of a reference to the concept of hauntology, or like the cultural memory of lost futures and the nostalgia for those lost futures. How does that play in with this idea of time?
You got me. All right. All right. Like, I'm trying not to squeal here, because, you know, you're the only person so far that has asked me about this stuff. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I mean, I think it's one of those things where I've touched on that already.
Sure,
for part,
sure.
In part, but there's so much more, evidently, right? Like, I think, you know, when I go into a project, I really make sure everything connects back into itself, you know, like it's all an Ouroboros, right? Like, you know, the snake eating itself. As soon as you're finished understanding everything, you find out that there's so much more, because it connects right back in. And so, you know, I think I'm not the first person to do this specifically, but, you know, if I'm going to make it about this, then I figured I had to follow in the path of, you know, what do you call it? Like, hypnagogic pop artists, you know, like
right.
Like a Ariel Pink, or like a James Ferraro, or like a Dean Blunt, where they really managed to encapsulate it like in sound, right? So things that sound old, but in a way where you can tell that there's something not quite right.
Right.
And I've had people tell me that, you know, even without knowing that they feel that, which tells me like, oh shit, like I really hit it, didn't I? I don't know if you feel the same way, but like, that's what I've gathered. Like, that that was my intention, and I suppose I hit it. And so a lot of the album's inspirations, as always, you know, are kind of gained from both like old, you know, 60s and 70s Latin American songwriters and more contemporary influences. Like, I'm really into a lot of my local DIY scene, and there's a lot of like post-hardcore, and there's a lot of, you know, like punk and stuff like that. Post-punk, noise rock, I think is big on this EP specifically. And so with that in mind, there's more than just the sonic aspect to it too, right? There's the lyrical aspects to a lot of it, which so for me, I conceived of it as a direct response to a lot of the more silly, I guess, presumptions from Francis Fukuyama's, you know, the laurels the end of history,
right.
And the last man. You know, a lot of it, you know, kind of being also refuted by Derrida in his work, the Spectres of Marx. Mm-hmm. You know, which you know, saying these things out loud, a lot of the song titles are like, wait a minute, these sound kind of familiar.
Uh-huh.
So for example, like one of the funniest, I guess, and I say this, you know, like I'm making fun of them. Like it's like, I think it's fucking stupid. I don't know if I can say that on air, but
we'll censor it out. We'll bleep it out.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Cool. I think it's very dumb. But in a way where you just kind of have to laugh at it, even though, you know, it's like, this is something people actually believe. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the supposition that, liberal democracy won out because of, like, it was the morally best thing there was.
Right.
You know, which is really funny when you know even a little bit about how it won in some of these countries, like Indonesia, sure, or Chile, you know, oh, very, very kind, very, very kind, you know, mm-hmm. Of course, you know, just so benevolent of an ideology. People just had no choice but to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. That's exactly what happened. And I think nowhere is it more evident than on The Lost Last Man, which The Lost Last Man, you know, being taken kind of from the title of the novel, it's also kind of an allegory. Who is the lost last man? It's the idea, because, you know, the title itself is deriving from the fact that liberal democracy is the last man standing, so to speak. Well, what about everyone else? Are you telling me that they all just bowed out? No. The lost last man is a kind of a representation of everyone who stood up to try and create something new in defiance of that and was killed for it, or, you know, cooled or whatever have you. You know, kind of an unpleasant reminder. I was talking with Hex, and you know Hex. And Hex defined it, or drew a comparison to that episode of SpongeBob where they have a kid, right? The clam. And like SpongeBob's like showing Patrick like all the diapers in the wall, you know? And I thought, you know, that's really funny because I actually totally understand where you're coming from. And that's kind of, I'm just like SpongeBob. Like, like, no, like there's, you got to look at the diapers in the wall. It's not that pleasant, you know?
That's a great compare. I have to go back and rewatch that episode now. That's really interesting.
No, like, and Hex is like, I'm sorry, like, I don't know if that's disrespectful. I was like, no, like, you don't understand. That's so spot on. You know, it's like the emotion of it, you know, just pure frustration.
Yeah, that adds a whole new layer of context to The Lost Last Man that I want to go back and listen to that now with. Because I did not catch I caught the Derrida reference. I did not catch the Fukuyama reference until you pointed it out. But yeah, I think that going back to the whole musical side of the hypnagogic aesthetic, I think it's a difficult line to walk between having it be that kind of really surreal feeling and just sounding kind of old and hackneyed. And I think you walk that line really well on this album. I think it's one of my favorite parts about it. I'm going to switch gears a little bit now and kind of talk more about the live performance aspect of your work. So you've been pretty prolific as a live performer in the past year. And so I'm wondering if you found that performing these songs live changes at all how you think about them, or if, you know, going into the writing process for Laurels, you found yourself writing differently at all, you know, with this live context added.
Oh, of course, you know, and I talk a lot about music as a language. Mm-hmm. You have studio recording and performance and songwriting, and you have live performance. Mm-hmm. Different languages. You know, it's like going from being an airplane pilot to a helicopter pilot. Some things are transferable, but, you know, you can't rest on that, you know, yourself. Yeah. You learn to adapt things and you know, things like virtuosity, which I think are kind of lame to go for on a studio album, become a lot more prominent, you know, like doing an awesome, epic guitar solo on a record. It's just like, okay, cool, I guess. But you do it live. It becomes a lot more, and I think it becomes a lot more interesting when you're there in that space. And yes, for sure, it has actually influenced the writing process on it a lot, to the point where, you know, I find myself even reflecting on a lot of the choices made, not saying I would correct them, right? I'm not saying I correct them, but kind of the choices made during Tikaroo. And like, if you listen to the live versions of the songs, they're completely different, not because I think they're flawed. I think that it's everything it needed to be, like I said, but more so, you know, like when you're a painter versus when you're a musician, let's say, if you want to portray sadness, you're doing them in two different ways, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're two different mediums. And I kind of see that the same way. For example, like on Tikaroo, there's a lot of, like, I was really inspired by, like, children's music in the delivery. And I think it gives it kind of certain wistfulness, right? Like, it's sad, but also in a very kind of, you know, poignant way, bittersweet. I don't think that necessarily works live. It just kind of sounds a little bit lame. So I've taken on more of, like, an intensive, I don't want to say screaming, but, like, you know, like emotional, hardcore, post-hardcore kind of approach, just because that's what works in a live setting.
Yeah.
And I found that really interesting, because I wouldn't say that my music is like that at all. But even when before I put out that album, I had people comparing it to it, which I kind of feels like Brave Little Abacus, where those people are not emo, but like they're an emo band. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So that's been really interesting, but it's also been a lot of fun, you know, especially recently, where more and more people have been like singing the song, and it's like, really, you know, like it's very sweet to me. Yeah, I think that's everything.
Yeah, going off of that, and you mentioned this in a previous response, you mentioned being influenced by the DIY scene that you're a part of in California. And, you know, of course, the internet has made it easier than ever to take influence from different scenes around the world. But do you find yourself taking particular influence from the Southern California DIY scene? And what does it mean to you to be an active member of a scene like that?
Yes. I said it before, but I'll kind of elaborate a bit more. You know,
sure.
Like I said, there's a lot of really great post-hardcore bands. There's a lot of really great noise rock bands. And one in particular, I have made a couple of friends in this band called Recluser, who just recently put out an EP. It's like recluse, but with an R. No, like not recluser, you know, like instead of the E, the R, you cut out the, got it, yeah.
Yeah.
For all the people at home or in the car. and so they're really interesting to me. And so what I find fascinating about my scene in particular is that So I think a lot of people are really big on the sound, like a cohesive sound of a scene. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I think that's really cool. But I think there's also something to be said about not doing that, as in just like taking influences from whatever you want and just forcing it to go into life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like forcing life from it, like Frankenstein's monster, you know, kind of the terror of it, but also like the fascination with it. And so what I appreciate about it is just the diversity, you know, like there's a lot, there's this band called Miss Daisy. They're like post-punk, but with rap, you know, like there's a, they have a hip hop vocalist, Cassius. He's really cool. There's Killjoy, which takes like, and this is going to sound like Midwest emo, but it's not. They take like, they, so it's funny because they used to be an indie rock band, but then they became a post-hardcore band playing the same songs. And you can kind of see like an interesting mix of them, especially when you listen to like them before mm-hmm. versus them now. Mm-hmm. And Recluser, which I brought up, they're like, so you probably know about this. You probably know about this because like you're online in this particular way, but not to air out your dirty laundry on the air. But like, there's like, you know, people, your music sometimes gets new genres in, like with the genre polls. Yeah. And people like to make fun of them sometimes. There's shit gaze right now, where it's like noise rock, garage rock, and shoegaze with uh-huh. post-hardcore. That's them. Like, and I didn't realize it. But I was like, because like, you know, thinking about it, it's like, that's not a genre. That's not a genre. Then I thought about it. I was like, oh my God, that's Recluser. Oh my. And I sent it to them. Like, hey, I found your genre. They're like, no, stop it. It's not true. It's not even real. I think it's really interesting because there's so much diversity in the scene, you know, so many black and brown people and really giving their own voices and their own perspectives. And so while there isn't really a cohesive sound, I think it's really beautiful in that way, in a reflection of the people, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right, one more question, and then we're going to get to the speed round. So earlier this year, you organized a split called Trans Folk, which had another I Hate Music guest, A.N. Tier, featured on it. So why folk music, and where do you see trans musicians as part of the folk tradition?
So the name itself, I want to say, because I'm so proud of it and no one ever asks me about it. So I'm just going to put this on the record. It's a very, very cool, in my opinion, triple entendre, in the sense that it's, you know, trans folk, as in trans people, trans folk, folk music made by trans people, mm-hmm. and trans folk, as in like avant folk, right?
Oh, okay. I got the double entendre. I did not realize the triple entendre until now.
That is right, like, because it's all very weird, but it's all very, you know, evidently folk, just in very weird and different directions.
Sure.
And so as for where I think they fit into it, I mean, they fit into it like in every genre. But sure. For me, I think it was important to let people know, maybe not in like a, you know, infographic way. I just wanted to say, you know, like you have to pay attention. I'm not like trying to nag anyone. Mm-hmm. More so to kind of showcase, you know, with my friends and I, like, hey, you know, there's more to trans people than just like, I don't know, you know, hardcore music, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But trans people can make any music. I mean, that seems like such an obvious thing to say, but mm-hmm. I think, you know, at times there's a lot of, you know, preconceived notions of what we are. And while I think it's a bit silly to say I'm breaking anything down, it's more so just for fun. You know, I found it important at the very least for us to do it. And it's fun. I thought it was really cool to see, you know, you listen to it and it's just such a weird collection of stuff. To kind of showcase both the diversity of folk, you know, it's probably the most nondescript genre there is. But also, you know, specifically even within an even smaller subsection of that, of trans people making folk music. There was a second part to that question, right? I feel like I'm missing.
I think you covered it all. And it's really exciting to see the full length projects coming out from those singles that were first released as
Trans. Yeah, Morgan's you're right.
And then Morgan's
I totally,
coming out soon.
Yeah. So I think awesome. Cass's is coming out pretty soon too. I gotta ask her. Yeah, and as for Walking on Glass, I'm not sure, but I'll have to see because it would be cool, you know. I really like their work. I think it's a really interesting addition in particular. But yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah, all right. Ready for the speed round?
For sure, yeah. Let's go.
All right. What was the last book you read?
Oh, my God. Radical History of the World.
Favorite live performance of your own ever?
My own? Oh, most recent one. 7/8.
Favorite live performance of someone else ever?
Widow Dusk, 9/8/2022.
What are your hobbies outside of creating music?
I like to read. I like to research. I mean, like, specifically, I like to... Oh, this isn't a one-word. This isn't even a one-word response, but I digress. I like to research particularly about American history. Surprise, surprise. I like to cook. I think cooking is fun. I like to host people. I think it's cool because you get to like, food is like a way of entering people's heart in no other way. You know, if you cook someone a nice meal, they'll trust you more than if you talk to them for weeks. You know.
Yeah. What's the biggest single inspiration for this album?
Oh Jesus! Single inspiration. Single. Okay. Single inspiration. Man, that's a good question. By a good question, I mean, give me a minute. Maybe you can, if it takes too long, you can edit out the silence.
We can go back to that one. Do you want to skip it?
Yeah, pass.
Best live music venue in SoCal?
Oh, SoCal. That's good. The Haven.
What's your favorite instrument that you recorded for Laurels?
As in, like, not a part, but like instrument.
Like specific instrument that is featured on the album.
Okay. That I recorded or that is on it?
That is on it. Doesn't have to be you.
Okay. Oh man, that's hard. Oof. I really like the. Okay, I'm gonna give you two. I'm gonna cheat.
Okay.
Probably the Theater Organ, of course. Uh-huh. Duh. That's just me cheating. Or the trumpet.
What is the best song or album to come out this year? That's not
you. Oh. Pass.
Okay, last one. Cassettes or CDs?
CDs.
All right. Want to go back to the biggest single inspiration for this album?
Yeah. Oh, I know it. It's Smile by the Beach Boys.
Ooh, that's a good one. All right. One last question. Not a speed round, so answer at your leisure. If you could tell listeners one thing to pay attention to or take away from Laurels, what would it be?
Okay. One thing. See, again, like, one thing. I think it would have to be that a better world is possible.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Thanks again for joining me today. Once again, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Sime. Her new album is called Laurels of the End of History, and it is out everywhere this Friday, August 18th. And now we're going to listen to a track or two off of it. So stay tuned. You're listening to WCWM Williamsburg.